Hey guys, welcome to tonight's episode of Pints and Puzzles. Tonight we are very lucky to have an interview with Chris Williamson, who is the project creator of the podcast and future documentary, Chasing Earhart. Honestly, this was such a great interview and really a lot of fun to put together, so I hope that you all enjoy it as much as I do. We'll be skipping any ad breaks and beer reviews tonight just to get right into the interview. But before I do that, I do want to sincerely thank Chris for taking the time to come on the show, and I strongly encourage all of you to check out, subscribe, and support the Chasing Earhart project. Okay, let's get right into it.
What's the podcast?
Find me a podcast.
You miss me to my dad. My dad shows the best.
All right. So tonight we are joined by Chris Williamson from the Chasing Earhart podcast. So hi, Chris. How you doing?
I'm well, sir. How are you doing today?
Great, great. It's nighttime for both of us after the holidays.
So, yes, it is.
You know, it's always a little bit of a crazy time. I know things are getting a little bit more crazy for you guys, so can't wait to talk about some of that. I'll start off with actually the way you start off all your interviews is tell me a little bit about your background and why we're talking to you a little bit.
All right. Wow. I haven't been on the other end of that question ever, so that's interesting. I'm happy to be here with you. It's been a long time coming. I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, so thanks for having me on. You know, as far as my background is concerned, it's really quite ordinary, to be honest with you. My background's mainly in IT, but that's kind of the case for most of the team. Almost everybody on the team has an IT background in one shape or another, So we come from different areas of IT. I've always been, you know, really big into just writing and reading and just in general, ever since I was a kid. It was kind of something that just came natural to me. And, you know, as far as how I got kind of into this whole thing and how this kind of snowballed into what it's become so far is it started out in third grade for me with Earhart. So, you know, that seems to be sort of the magic year that everybody gets kind of introduced to Amelia Earhart in one way or another. And for me, it really, again, just no different, pretty ordinary. But I remember it well. It was a History Day project like so many that, you know, are still done today. Our teacher put a bunch of 8x10s up on the wall around the room of American icons. And you had your, your Lincolns and your Washingtons, your Harriet Tubmans, your MLKs and Theodore Roosevelt, JFK, all those people. And then you had this woman that at the time I had no idea who she was. And it ended up being the famous bomber jacket photo that everybody's probably seen 100 times of Earhart with her hands on her hips and all that good stuff. And, you know, no one had picked her, oddly enough, after a couple of days. I don't think anybody really knew who she was just by sight. And so after a few days, I kind of kept coming back to that photo and I decided to pick her. And I did a History Day project on her and I just sort of fell in love with her story and her life and kind of what she, even at that age, what she kind of represented. And, you know, for me, it was one of those things where it was just kind of meant to be. So when I did that original History Day project, I remember just having so much fun with it. And, you know, come fourth grade, I did another one on it, and fifth grade, I did another one, and sixth grade, I did another one, and so on and so forth. I kind of always came back to Amelia Earhart all the way up through high school and college, and I would write papers on her and you know, all these different things. So she was always sort of a staple for me as a kid all the way up through my adult years, and that sort of blossomed into about 2008 or so, or roughly, when I started doing pre-research for what would become Chasing Earhart at that time.
Wow. So you've been working at this for quite some time then.
Yeah. I mean, officially for about 9 years, unofficially pretty much all my life. I think that's really, again, I mean, my story is not very different from a lot of the folks that we interview on our podcast and in our documentary that we're shooting. Is everybody sort of comes to Amelia. Well, not everybody, but most people come to her really early in life. They have really early recollections of Amelia Earhart, usually early in their grade school lives. And, you know, I'm no different. I just kind of, everybody's got a unique little story of how they kind of fell into it. But, it's pretty common. Everybody gets introduced to her pretty early.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those bugs for sure where you get bit early, I think, and then kind of can't let it go.
Definitely. I think
I was re-listening to make sure we didn't overlap too much. I know we'll overlap a little bit to the Astonishing Legends interview you did, which was phenomenal, of course. But I know, I think Forrest was mentioning how it was kind of similar to Oak Island, where you get bit by the bug early on and then just kind of can't let it go for some people. And it sounds like Earhart definitely has that same kind of effect on people for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great American mystery. It's one of those great American mysteries, you know, like Oak Island. You get bit early and you just can't let go. You put it really nicely. It's one of those things that kind of swallows you whole. And it's a story not unlike John F. Kennedy and you know, the Abraham Lincoln assassination and John Wilkes Booth and D.B. Cooper and all those other fascinating stories. You can just go down multiple rabbit holes. The Amelia Earhart case is one of the most, if not, dare I say, the most famous missing persons case ever. And it's one of those things where she was such a high-profile woman at the time that she disappeared, arguably the most recognizable and popular woman on the face of the earth, and she just vanished into thin air. And, you know, no oil slick, no parts, no wreckage, no nothing. She just vanished. And when you look at her life 39 years before she disappeared, you know, and all the wonderful things that she accomplished and all the glass ceilings that she shattered, and everything that you get to before you get to the fact that she disappeared mysteriously, it's pretty incredible. And it's a case that you can really sort of, if you do even a little bit of research, see why people sort of just get swallowed up whole by this story. There's so much data out there on this case, the mind reels. And, you know, you wouldn't think so. She only flew professionally for 9 years. You would have thought, you know, this would be something you could knock out in a few months. And, you know, you would have thought, you know, after a while, you'd think that she flew for 100 years because there's that much data on her.
Yeah, there's just so many different stories. You mentioned JFK, and that's kind of my bug. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, mm-hmm. part of it is too that you start researching the theories and like kind of the conspiracy side, right? The fun meat and potatoes side. But then you get into the human aspect and it's just as interesting. And I think that's where Chasing Earhart specifically dives more beyond just the theories and kind of the conspiracy angle, even though you guys do cover that. I like that you add in those guests randomly that talk about like the feminism side and the inspiring the mm-hmm. kids, and kind of nice to see that these kids are starting to get a little bit of exposure into this strong woman from the past who had a cool life beyond just her disappearance.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's exciting for us. I mean, I cannot tell you how many young, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old girls I see, you know, coming up to us dressed up as Amelia Earhart, full-blown, full cosplay as Amelia Earhart, and they know exactly who she is. It's not just the costume their parents threw on them. It's something that, you know, they wanted to be. And not only that, but little boys, too. I mean, this is a woman who, and I've said this countless times, and I'll continue to say it, you know, her example 80 years after she disappeared, you know, demonstrates to kids now that you can truly have, do, or be anything you want. There mm-hmm. is no... there is no ceiling. There is no glass ceiling. Just shatter right through it. Just go right through it. There's no, you know, there's nothing you cannot do. This is a woman who just did not understand the word no, even though she heard it probably hundreds and hundreds of times and had multiple doors slammed in her face. She just didn't understand that word. And it was a word that just wasn't in her vocabulary.
You know, it almost seemed like that would drive her more. The more doors that are slammed into her face, the more it kind of, you know, lit the fire a little bit more.
Yeah, I agree. I think people can choose to go one of two ways. You know, you can have these doors slam in your face and you can choose to give up, or you can choose to use that for fuel and just keep going. And I think that's what she did. And, you know, it's an example that, you know, we talk to so many young women in aviation and aerospace and things. And there's so many young women out there that are just kind of look up to this woman who was mysteriously vanished 80 years ago. It's like she just kind of was here to break ground, to shatter glass ceilings. And then she just kind of flew off into the sunset. And that was it. And that's kind of how we prefer to kind of push her and to showcase her is through the examples of these young women that are doing these phenomenal things with their lives right now. These young women that take inspiration from a woman who lived 80 years ago. It's really kind of special to be at the forefront of that and to just kind of sit back and witness all that. For us, it's really exciting.
Yeah, I agree. Especially when you see, you know, when they have the influences like the Kardashians and all that stuff. And to get the other extreme, you know, where it's kind of cool that there's still some hope left out there, that they're being inspired by some other things than just reality TV. So it's great.
I would agree.
So my audience, I think, is kind of split with people that either have dove completely headfirst into Earhart and know a lot mm-hmm. about it, or have at the very least listened to the, you know, Astonishing Legends type series on it. And then there's the people who are just like, oh, what, didn't she disappear back in the day and that was it? You know? So how would you say for the latter group, how would you describe Chasing Earhart to them?
Well, That's a great question. I would just describe it by telling them about her life. This is a woman, yes, most famously known for, you know, wasn't she the pilot who disappeared mysteriously, or wasn't she the pilot that crashed at sea and was never heard from again, or tried to fly around the world, or, you know, we've heard a lot of different aspects of it. But what I tell them is, really, it's just like anybody else. You know, you have to have passion for something to really investigate it further. And what we try to do as a team is really just showcase the little aspects of Amelia's life from the cradle to the disappearance that will kind of allow someone to latch onto her in one way or another. And that's I think, what a lot of people have done so far, is they've latched onto one aspect of Amelia's life, whether it be the fact that she was a conscientious, objector. She was a radical, you know, she was a feminist. She wasn't really big on alcohol. I know that's probably a hit for your show, but she wasn't big on alcohol. And we can get into why. There's a really interesting story behind that. With Amelia, there really just kind of sort of was, you know, there's no vagueness, really, to be honest with you. The only vagueness is in the disappearance, which I think is really interesting when you look at it. Every aspect of her life, there's a reason for what she did. There's a method to that madness. And I think it's just like anybody else. If we were to do, you know, a podcast on John F. Kennedy or Abraham Lincoln or any one of those aspects of it, people would, you know, have an assumption going in of, well, yeah, he was just the president who, you know, freed the slaves and got assassinated. Well, sure, that's two aspects of it, but there's a lot more to it. And you really have to kind of dive headfirst into it if you really want to get the whole effect of the Chasing Earhart project. It's not something you can kind of passingly listen to. It's a very direct audience. We have a very specific audience that we try to hit. But there's a lot of young women, regardless of, you know, their race, their, you know, anything like that, that were inspired by Amelia Earhart. We just recently released episode, I think it's 22 now, with Susan Butler. And Susan wrote one of the definitive, if not the definitive, biography on Amelia Earhart called East of the Dawn. And during that interview, we learned together, live on air, or live on the show, when she was doing research and kind of researching Amelia's work at Purdue University as a sort of a, not a full-blown professor, but she kind of was an advisor for women. And she kind of did guest teachings and guest lectures and things, that she, meaning Susan Butler, received countless letters from women that were alive at that time still, that remember Amelia being in their classroom and actually talking to them.
Wow.
And these letters are amazing. They're like, you know, I was going to be a stay-at-home mom, or I was going to do this or that and everything, but because of Amelia Earhart, I became an engineer.
Wow.
Or I started studying mathematics and I became a mathematician, or I did a, you know, I got into aerospace, or I got into aviation or whatever, because Amelia even then inspired women that in many different ways. She explained to them that you're more than just, you know, a wife or a mother, or just, you know, you have more to offer this world. And this was a woman who, this was in the 1930s, in the late 1920s, you know, women didn't really have a lot of say so and a lot of expectation at that point, but she kind of bared that weight so that, and of course we're not there yet, but she bared that weight so a lot of women today don't have to bear it as bad. I think if it wasn't for Amelia Earhart, you know, you can throw away the aviation. Aviation is just, you can use that. That's a catalyst. She could have been a race car driver in a different era or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's because of women like Earhart that you have a Danica Patrick in NASCAR. You have people like that. The ripples are ridiculous in every great way you can imagine. And so, you know, that's kind of how I would explain to people that are not, you know, very familiar with Earhart beyond the fact that she disappeared or beyond the fact that she was an aviatrix or whatever. Look into this woman's life. Pick any area. You don't have to go deep dive. Just pick an area. Pick, you know, look at her time in Purdue. Google search the Purdue collection, the Amelia Earhart collection at Purdue. You'll get lost in that, in the very best possible way. It's incredible. This is a woman that on multiple platforms and multiple aspects affects young men and young women almost 100 years after she disappeared. It's pretty incredible. Not very many people can, you know, you can't really say that about very many people. So,
and that's one of the things that I went in first for the theories, right? To see what the sure. You know, what other angles you had other than the, you know, the main big ones that were kind of out there.
Yeah.
And we'll get into the theory side in just a sec, but the life aspect was the part that I never really knew a lot about going into it. It's kind of like for my podcast, some people will come for the beer and then stay on the theories, or come for the theories and then learn about beer. Come in for one reason and then you get hooked and then start learning a lot about the other stuff. And that's one of the reasons that I continue to listen to you guys on the Chasing Earhart, because it's very interesting, the bigger picture and the bigger influence that she had beyond just, this is an awesome woman who happened to disappear. We want to figure out why we don't have an answer to this 80 years later, you know? So I thought that, I thought that was exactly right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you make some excellent points there. And I think, yeah, and we'll definitely get into the different hypotheses regarding the disappearance and stuff. And you know, we can go as deep as you want on that, because that is a big part of Chasing Your Heart. But it really is a testament to our team, I think, and I like to really praise them as much as I can, is that, you know, when we have somebody on the show, if you look at the hypotheses and you look at that aspect of, you know, of the project, every time we have someone on the show, you know, we really are non-judgmental. We're not biased in any way, shape, or form. If I have somebody from Tiger on the show for that interview, I am all in on the Tiger hypothesis. Yeah. I will present it in the best possible light that I can, because as a team, we want to completely put it out there, uncompressed, untruncated, with no objections or anything, because it's not for us to object. It's for, you know, people to inspire people to do their own research. And if they don't agree with it, that's totally fine. But the point is, you know, there's camps, just like Forrest said in the Astonishing Legends show, in the interview we did, there's camps, and he's absolutely right. You have the Japanese capture hypothesis camp and everything that goes underneath that umbrella. You have the Nikumaru or Island Castaway camp and everything that goes under that. You have the Crash at Sea. You have the Irene Bolam. You have now the Buka thing that's starting to emerge a little bit. You have all these different folks that are talking about these individual hypotheses. And our job is just to showcase their talent, showcase their data, their analysis, their information, their knowledge, whatever you want to call it, and put it out there in the best possible light. And maybe inspire somebody to say, if they hear the, you know, the episode with Rick Gillespie on it or something, and he says something that triggers them and they want to go do their own research. That's a win for our team. That's a big deal. If they hear the Bill Snavely episode talking about Buka, and it's a brand new, well, relatively new, it's the newest hypothesis out there, maybe they never heard of that one before, and they thought, you know, this is one that actually has a plane. Man, let's go check this out. It's our job as a team to put it all out there. And the reason why you may not have heard of it is because a lot of people are very biased towards one hypothesis or another, so they don't really give these people the correct platform. And our job is nothing more than this. Really, when it comes down to the hypotheses, it's very, very simple. We offer the same platform to everyone, every hypothesis, and we put it out there. It's not for us to decide. It's for you guys to decide. It's for the Chasing Your Heart audience to decide what they want to believe happened to Amelia Earhart. I always tell people, you know, Amelia Earhart sort of belongs to history now.
That's a cool perspective.
And her, you know, her and Fred Noonan belong to us all now. They belong to history, and their chapter is unwritten. And it's like Scott said it beautifully. It's like a season finale that hasn't been written yet.
Yeah.
And it really is. And, you know, our job is to sort of assist in any way, shape, or form that we can to help write that season finale. Maybe through our project and through, you know, talking to all these people, a breakthrough occurs, and maybe somebody stumbles upon something that they never would have seen before because they're too closed-minded at certain things. You know, whatever, however you want to look at it, we are very honored now that because of our project, you know, we're kind of the liaison, we're kind of like an acting liaison for folks to work together that never in a million years would have ever worked together because they have exact opposing viewpoints on something. And for us, it's a matter of, look at, just throw all that stuff aside, you know, throw all the name calling and the insults and the arguing aside, throw out your data, put it all there. And if it doesn't make sense, that's fine. But just work together, because these are the smartest people out there on the subject, and we're just trying to showcase them as much as we possibly can. And, you know, we've been very fortunate and very blessed to be able to have overwhelming positive support for the project and what we're trying to do, not only by people that are listening to the show and following along, you know, project members. I don't call them fans. I hate that word. If they join, you know, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, they're project members, or they subscribe to the website. They put their input in, they do their own research. They might call me on something and say, oh, I disagree with what you said here. That's beautiful. We love that. That's not a problem. We're not the be all end all. We are just trying to be a catalyst for something to change in this community and something to change, you know, within the research and within the knowledge. And if people can just listen to our show and just, here's, you know, 23 episodes so far, or 20, we're about to be 23 episodes of unbiased, unedited content that you can listen to, and then it puts it all out there. Hey, that gets people started, you know, and in the documentary shooting the whole time is exciting. And I'm sure we'll get into that, but it's, you know, it's just one of those things that we try to be there for everybody. And we try to give the same respect to every single project guest that allows us the time to interview them.
So do you have any kind of filtering process? Because somebody came in and was like, oh, I think she's abducted by aliens or something like that. Is there some kind of minor filtering process just to make sure that...
I would say project over at that point. We already we found out what happened now. No, you know, there is a filter. Okay. I mean, obviously, we can't just take anybody who wants to talk to us and you know, and say, hey, I have this theory. They have to, the filter is really this. If the evidence supports what you're talking about in any way, shape, or form, as far as, you know, your information out there, then we'll listen to you. You know, we'll provide an option for you. But if you're just kind of saying, well, I think this is what happened to her, and this is why I think it, well, you know, then, I mean, everybody would share an opinion at that point of what they believe happened to her and Fred Noonan and, yeah. and why they believe that. But if somebody comes to us and says, look, this is what I believe. I believe this is what happened. I have this evidence to support it. This is basically, it's like the old mathematics in grades, or I guess in junior high, and we started doing it. Long division, show your work. I always tell people, you know, if you can show your work and your work backs up what you're talking about, if you're right or wrong, that's not for us to decide, but we're at least going to give you the platform to put it out there. But I mean, again, it has to make sense to our team. It has to, you know, it can't just be like, well, I think she's abducted by aliens because there in this day there was a light over the sky. And well, you got to give us some hardcore, I don't want to say evidence, but just at least hardcore, you know, number crunching, some stuff. And if someone's worked at a particular hypothesis for 10 years, I mean, obviously they have something to it that they really believe. And we want to showcase that. And if people don't, you know, buy it, that's not up to us. We just want to say, hey, look, we found this new interesting thing. Let's put it out there. And if you want to believe it, or if you want to buy it, or if you want to, you know, do all your own research and kind of look into it some more yourself, that's great. But our job is just kind of compartmentalize everything and put it out there. And that's sort of the filter that we use.
Without spoiling too much, you know, obviously I don't want any spoiler alerts for future episodes, but what are some of the more out there ones that at least you've heard, even if you aren't necessarily going to have them in the documentary or on the podcast? Is there a legit alien theory behind her? I'll be honest,
oh, yeah.
I haven't
There's
actually
a legit alien, yeah. So I think anytime something mysterious happens, aliens are right at the head of the pack. And then you have the Bermuda Triangle thing where people think she flew over the Bermuda Triangle. And the Bermuda Triangle was what caused her to disappear and you know, have all the radio issues and things like that. And that's kind of an interesting thing to look at. But, you know, there's never been any kind of evidence to support it. And then you have the idea that, you know, she didn't want to be famous anymore and that she and Fred Noonan fell in love and ran off together. And again, no evidence to ever support anything like that. They were not romantically involved in any way, shape, or form. They had, you know, a very respectful, you know, business relationship. She admired Fred, even though she wasn't a big fan of his drinking. We can't get into that.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I always thought they were married. When I was younger, you know, I always thought that they were husband and wife. So it's funny that you know, obviously learning since then that they were not, but that they really did have more of that business relationship and were able to keep that separate somehow. So it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, Fred Noonan's a guy who really gets lost in a lot of this. And, people don't realize that, you know, she was supposed to have a bigger crew. You know, she was supposed to have Manning on the crew. She was supposed to have a couple other people on the crew. And they just thought it all kind of dropped out for various reasons or another, especially after the, you know, the kind of fallout from the ground loop incident in Hawaii when they're originally supposed to take off on the world flight, the first attempt. Mm-hmm. Fred Noonan was, you know, he had been let go from Pan Am. He was looking for a fresh start. He was newly remarried. And this is a man who saw this as an opportunity to, hey, you know, when I complete this world flight with Amelia, I can get back. I can open up my own navigation school. This was a man that was the man at the time when it came to celestial navigation. There was no better celestial navigator on the planet than Fred Noonan. If you're going to be going on a world flight like this, equatorial, and you're going to be trying to knock this out, that's the guy you want to have in the plane with you. So there was no question that the man himself was phenomenal at what he did, and he would have been the guy. I mean, it just is what it is. But, you know, he was very brave to go on this flight after the ground loop. He could have got scared like everybody else and just kind of abandoned ship. And, you know, we don't know for sure, I mean, if Manning, you know, abandoned ship because he didn't trust Earhart's skills or because he had a legitimate reason for heading back or whatever. But, you know, it's one of those situations where Fred decided, no, I'm all in till it's over. And he went with her. And, you know, we're going to give Fred Noonan his due. We've already talked to Gary LaPook, who is one of our project guests, and he's one of the foremost authorities on celestial navigation on the planet himself. Now, you know, he kind of took us through Fred Noonan's shoes, kind of in on how he did things and how he would have done stuff back in that time. And we're going to be talking to some of the extended family of Fred Noonan. One of the episodes of the documentary is going to be dedicated specifically to Fred Noonan completely. And some of the episodes for the podcast will be dedicated to Fred Noonan specifically, as will be George Putnam and Muriel Earhart, Amelia's sister, and you know, a few other people that surrounded Earhart that were very big and important in her life.
Yeah, I heard you alluded to the Fred Noonan stuff. And one of the other episodes kind of got me excited to hear, we get to hear a little bit more about this guy beyond that he was a great navigator and he may or may not have had a drinking problem that may or may not have been an issue in this particular flight, depending on, you know, who you listen to.
Who you talk to.
You guys didn't cover any of that side yet, right?
As far as
you know, basically Fred being too drunk and that's why they crashed.
Yeah, some of our guests have touched on it in the episodes. Everybody pretty much, you know, it's the general consensus, and it's up for debate. I completely admit that. But that, you know, Fred did have a drinking problem, but Fred was stone cold when it came to doing what he had to do on that flight. And if he had been drinking on that flight, he would not have been able to navigate in the quality and the manner of which he navigated. And, you know, there's a lot of speculation of kind of, did Fred and Amelia get into a tiff or a fight the night before they're supposed to leave New Guinea because he was on a bender and he was just not happy with everything? Again, that's speculation. That's up to who you want to believe. But I can tell you right now that, you know, a lot of people believe and say, and there's even some evidence to support that Fred was studying the actual flight pattern charts the night before they took off. He was not drinking and he was completely stone cold sober. And even if he was drunk, this is a guy who could just turn on the switch and just be completely in, you know, in the moment. You know, to say that navigation was kind of like second nature for him was really kind of an understatement. So we've had some people allude to that, but it hasn't been covered in great detail. But when we get into the Fred Noonan episodes, I think we'll definitely talk to some of his extended family who have, you know, have some of his letters and some of his writings and stuff. And it's, you hear right from the horse's mouth himself. So can't get much more clean than that.
I would think too that being how strong Amelia seemed is that she wouldn't have even put up with it if he was, you know, hungover or anything. Nope. You know, that's just how I saw. She would have been like, okay, you can stay here, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, no, she didn't put up with that on the friendship flight. She certainly wouldn't have put up with that on the world flight. This was her swan song. She wanted to go out with a bang. She had a real issue with alcohol. Amelia never drank herself. She had, you know, her dad had a lot of issues with alcohol when she was little, and she kind of experienced the fallout of that firsthand.
Okay.
And ever since that time, she just had absolutely no tolerance for drinking. This is a woman who wouldn't even serve alcohol at her home. And, you know, this is in Toluca Lake when she lived with GP there. And this is a woman who she was basically rubbing shoulders with, you know, the Hollywood elite at the time. She was friends with the president and Eleanor Roosevelt, very close friends. She didn't like it at all. She drank tomato juice and hot cocoa when she flew. You know, it was a real deep personal issue with her. And so if Fred was really drunk, just fall down drunk or whatever, one, she wouldn't have allowed it to get to that point. And two, if she was, I think she would have left him.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like too. And that's interesting too, that she had those scars, for lack of a better term, that kind of made her so opposed to it. And then Noonan was her co-pilot essentially too, along with their navigator. That's interesting.
Yeah, you got to believe he probably ended up in that cockpit at some point, especially towards the end, if you believe that they did go down in the ocean and they did go down in the drink, as Leo Bellart said, that you got to believe from time to time, he probably, you know, left his navigating area, especially when the weather was good and they knew where they were going.
So I always was in the Japanese capture, that camp for me. Now, that's to say, until you did your Astonishing Legends interview, they always kind of mess things up for me. And I mean that in the most respectful way possible.
No, they make you think. That's what they do.
I always threw out the Irene Bolin theory. Yeah. But then you guys tied that in where it actually fits into the Japanese capture theory and the spy theory. And actually, that was one of my favorite things originally that you guys had talked about was, I think the Robert Wheeler episode came out before your Astonishing Legends one. And then he dove really far into that whole government spy thing. That was my personal favorite, obviously, being the more conspiratorial minded.
Oh, yeah.
Do you buy in any of that for you personally?
Definitely an interesting hypothesis. And the Irene Bolin thing, well, here, we'll back up a little bit. So the very first person I ever reached out to, and I want to give him a shout out because I consider him a friend. His name is Todd Swindell. And he is the foremost authority on Irene Bolin in the world. The guy knows this story front and back. He knows like he knows like he knows that she was Amelia Earhart. There is no second guessing. There is no maybe not. There is nothing like that. She was Amelia Earhart. That is what he knows. And he has dedicated a good portion of his life to putting that theory or that hypothesis front and center. And I remember when I interviewed him, and the reason why I reached out to him first was because I saw that, you know, this particular hypothesis was really kind of swept under the rug a lot by a lot of the Earhart community who just simply didn't believe it, by a lot of the mainstream media who didn't believe it, who just thought it was a crazy, crazy idea. And I thought, well, great, let's start with that, because that's kind of an interesting way to go. We really wanted to give everybody their due when it came to talking about this. And in this case, we wanted to give the Irene Bolam hypothesis a second look, but a good one, a really good detailed look when it came to this woman, who had a very mysterious past, who just kind of popped up out of nowhere, who, you know, basically knew more from prop to tail about an airplane than anyone that flew airplanes, yet there's no record of her ever flying a plane, ever. A woman who seemed to know and be very well connected within the aviation community and the military community. A woman who is sort of at the center of a lot of the Earhart conspiracy and Earhart lore. If, in fact, she is not Amelia Earhart, and I say if because I don't, you know, try to proclaim that that's the case. I leave it up to our audience to determine that. But if, in fact, she is not Amelia Earhart, this woman was somebody. Something was up. Something was wrong here with this woman. Something was up. And we really wanted to give the Irene Bolam hypothesis its due, and that's what we're about to be doing in a short time. Our retrospective series is called Enter Irene Bolam, and it's really going to give people a way to sort of give this a real detailed second look. And if at the end you want to throw it out or you don't believe it's the case, that's not a problem. You go do, you know, just like everything else we put out, whatever you decide you want to believe happened to Amelia Earhart, that's going to be ultimately your choice. But the Irene Bolam case is very interesting, and it's got multiple rabbit holes just in and of itself. And this is a woman who was just very mysterious in multiple ways and multiple aspects of her life. And we want to shine the spotlight on her, perhaps for the first time, unequivocally, without any kind of truncation or without any kind of objection. And Todd has given us a lot of great information. He's got a very detailed forensic study, a very detailed handwriting study that you can go on his website. If you just Google search Todd Swindell, Amelia Earhart, or even Amelia Earhart, Irene Bolam, it's right at the top of the pack, and Google will come right up. That site, I would invite anybody who doesn't believe that particular hypothesis or isn't familiar with it or wants to kind of get to know it a little bit more and give it its fair shake to check out that website, because it's like a lot of the other hypotheses. I love how Forrest, you know, kind of related this on the show. It's like those people that test cars. It's like you test these cars and like, oh, this is the best car ever. It's got everything. And then you get the next car like, oh man, this is the best car ever. It's got everything on it. It's kind of the same concept. You can take any one of these hypotheses. You can take Nikumaruro. You can take Japanese capture. You can take Irene Bolam. You can take Crash and Sink in and of itself. And you can lay this down. You can look at it. And you can be like, I'm sold. This is what happened to her, until you see the next one. And it's really kind of, and that itself is a draw in for a lot of folks. And just doing the talkbacks after the Astonishing Legends episode and talking with all the folks that, you know, are the fan base of that show that listen to it, it's pretty incredible that people are starting to give these other hypotheses through our show or through our project a fair shake. And they're starting to look at these things. Well, no, the ears don't look very right. Like, you can't, the ears don't lie. Like, you know, it's really great to see that kind of feedback that we're receiving as a project. And if we can be a catalyst for some kind of change in that field, then we will. And it, you know, Irene Bolam is just a perfect example of that. And we're getting ready to launch a retrospective series with some guests. I wish I could tell you who they are, but there's some of the highest power people on the planet that are going to be involved in this retrospective series. And it's going to blow people's minds when they see who we have involved in this that actually believe that Irene Bolam, that the people like Joe Jervis and Joe Kloss and Todd Swindell and people that really believe that she was Amelia Earhart are in fact onto something. And maybe it's not that she was Amelia Earhart, but maybe Irene Bolam was something totally different. And stay tuned. We'll find out all together, hopefully.
Now that we've kind of dove deeper into the Irene Bolam thing, which I like, why do you think it hasn't gotten the spotlight previously compared to some of these other theories? I know for me personally, it seemed more like a one-off, and that could just be how History Channel or different programs that I've seen have just not given it as much focus.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Todd, you know, to quote Todd Swindell, the mystery exists because it's supposed to exist. And I think, and I love that quote, and I think it's very true. I think the mystery is kind of its own animal. And, you know, I think the Amelia Earhart, Irene Bolam thing, you know, gotta keep in mind when this whole thing came out, Irene Bolam herself unequivocally denied. I am not, I mean, she, if you, you can still search the actual press conference. She held the book upside down, like a upside down crucifix, and she stomped on the book and walked out of the press conference. She was adamant. I am not Amelia Earhart. I'm not a mystery woman. I am just me. This is ridiculous. And she sued the maker or the publisher of the book. And, you know, she sued, of course, Joe Kloss and Joe Jervis, who wrote the book. And she won. You know, she won the lawsuit because the judge found that, you know, she had been, in fact, slandered and, you know, was kind of dragging her name through the mud and all that stuff. And And this was, you know, and it's been speculated by a lot of people of what the amount that she was awarded was. It's truthfully awarded a lot of money, but there's no figure. I mean, people speculate on what the figure would have been. But, you know, when she was asked for her prints, she drops the case. And, you know, all she had to do was give a set of fingerprints. If you are not who you say you are, and all you got to do is give someone a set of prints to prove it. I mean, you know, let's take the prints and give me my money. That's not a problem.
Exactly.
But this is a woman that, and again, it doesn't mean that she was Amelia. It doesn't automatically mean she was Amelia Earhart, but it does mean that she had something to hide. And whether or not she was Amelia Earhart, whether or not she was in on the Amelia Earhart thing, which is sort of a tease for the retrospective, we'll kind of get into that in much detail. Whether or not she knew Amelia Earhart and knew what was going on, and whether or not she played a role in the disappearance or played a role in the recovery or whatever, however you want to look at it. And we'll cover that in great detail. This woman knew something was someone, something happened. And I don't know what that was. And, you know, we're not privy to that information just yet, but we might be pretty soon. But it's very interesting to kind of see, you know, how that whole thing was just kind of shunned. And I think maybe the lawsuit had a lot to do with that. Fact that it was kind of proven to be slander only because, you know, they won in a court of law, or she won in a court of law, doesn't mean it was slander. It just means it was, you know, they lost their case.
See, to me, I feel like it actually gives more credence the other way when, yeah, she lost the lawsuit up until the, okay, prove it. This is how you win in those kind of, like, you know, slander libel lawsuits, is to prove that it's not true, right?
Yeah, so
that,
show your work.
You know, that to me would be more of a red flags.
Well, yeah, if that happened today, if there was a big high-profile case like that today and that happened, and she sued the publisher and she wins the case, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's public knowledge, they ask her for prints, she drops the case, I'm thinking, holy hell, this thing just got much more interesting. Mm-hmm. Why would she not just give the prints up? So, you know, again, it doesn't mean she was Earhart, but it's really interesting. And it's one of those things that, like, you know, she's forever tied with Amelia Earhart now. And we're just going to give it its due because I think it deserves it. I think it warrants it. Our team certainly does. The work that, you know, Joe Jervis and Joe Kloss went to the graves with, the work that Todd Swindell keeps up the fight on it. You know, it's we just really want to showcase it and give the general public a really good look at this. And like, look at, just check this out. If you don't believe it's the case, that's totally fine. But you should pour over this with the same detail that you pour over the Gardner Island hypothesis, Nikamaru, you know, Japanese capture, all that stuff. And really, it's like I told Scott and Forrest on the show on Astonishing Legends, you know, people think it's such a wild, crazy idea. And I said to them, and I'll tell it to you and your audience now, what's really interesting about the Irene Bolam hypothesis, and if you look at the Japanese capture side by side, the only major difference between the two hypotheses is that one, she dies on that island, and one, she makes it out and she lives. And why wouldn't it be nicer to think that maybe she made it out and she lived? It's not that far-fetched. It might be pretty crazy, but I can tell you this much. If there was somebody that was connected enough to get the resources and get the people involved to get her the hell out of there, it would have been Amelia Earhart. This is a woman who was best friends with Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady. Think she didn't have some influence over FDR? I think just a little bit.
Just a little, right?
And FDR was a close personal friend of Amelia and George Putnam. And you think George wasn't whispering and FDR's ear, go get my wife?
I mean, kind of switching gears a little, but that was one of my other things too, is, I mean, George Putnam, for perspective, he was a huge Hollywood bigwig and tons of money. And I always wondered with, like, his pull and money, why wasn't he able to find something, you know? It's not like there was a shortage of money on his end.
Well, that's a common misconception. There was a real shortage of money on his side. Now, pull all day, every day. He had a lot of pull. He really did. This was a guy who wrote, you know, who published Lindbergh's book 5 years before him. Amelia came along. You know, he did have a lot of money at one time. He was, you know, pretty well off. He took really good care of Amelia. And he had a lot of pull more so than money. You got to keep in mind, what's interesting about this whole case, and, you know, we're going to kind of talk about this a little more in detail, but what's interesting about this is, you know, they financed, Purdue University put up the money to finance for the plane, for the Lockheed Electra 10E originally. And when they ground looped that plane, they were out of money at that point. They really kind of mortgaged everything they had to kind of make this world flight happen. And so when the world flight happens, and it's not successful the first time around, and she ground loops, they're kind of in panic mode at this point because it's going to cost a lot of money to repair the plane. The plane has some extensive damage on it. And there's been a lot of rumor and innuendo and a lot of data that supports it, that the United States government at that point stepped in and assisted in getting the planes repaired. And they took 11 different branches of the government to come together to get the money together. And this is in the middle of the Great Depression. You gotta keep this in mind.
Yeah.
To make this plane, make this plane whole again. And it's a very strong possibility that in order for that to become a reality, that the people involved in making that plane come together again for them said, we're going to do this for you, but you're going to do something for us. And that ties into the beginning of what a lot of people believe ended up being the Japanese capture hypothesis. And so it's a very interesting kind of way to look at it. It's a lot of very interesting information.
Not like there was necessarily a PR campaign that the U.S. government, where they would need to invest that many different resources into fixing this plane. The thing I always think is interesting, just because they may or may not have put this into her plane doesn't necessarily mean she was privy to that. And I think that was an interesting thing where it's like, you know, she may have not had any idea, or Fred may not have had any idea, or neither of them. One would think with her ties that she probably would have been told something, but you know, maybe if they're like, oh, we want to protect our friend, we're not going to say anything and just do this.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a woman who was very headstrong, very headstrong. If she didn't want to do something, she didn't do it. She was not about war. You know, she was very against war.
Mm-hmm.
And this is pre-World War II, obviously. And, you know, it would have been one of those situations where FDR or someone in the U.S. government said, look, they're mobilizing and we need to, you know, we have a lot of outdated imagery. We need to take some photos. You know, there's a lot of information that's floating around out there as far as, you know, how that would have went down, if it would have went down regarding, you know, simply taking photos, all the way to faking a disappearance and just kind of hanging out on an island and giving the U.S. government the excuse to go mobilize the largest land and sea search ever at that point, to go and search for their girl and bring her home, and at the same time take photographs of all that area.
That's a different perspective. I like that.
There's a lot of ways you could go with that. And we cover all that in the show and in the podcast. And it's very fascinating. And it's gotten a lot of people thinking and a lot of people doing their own research, which is sort of the goal of the show and the goal of the podcast. And, you know, it's something that we're happy to do for people. And we're happy to kind of be the platform to allow this information to get out there.
What do you think it is about cases like this, or like Kennedy, or at least that's the biggest parallel I see in my head, right? As far as it could have been the simplest answer, or it could be all these different rabbit holes. And like, what do you think it is about Amelia's case that keeps everybody interested?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's really just two words. It's just not knowing. That's really what it is. It's the mystery of it all. You know, this is a woman who disappeared, you know, over the Pacific Ocean, seemingly vanished off the face of the earth. No oil slick, no wreckage, no remains, just vanished into thin air. One of the most famous women on the planet at the time. There is and there has been no resolution. We're going on 81 years now. You know, it's one of those situations where since we don't know, it's natural for all these different hypotheses to sort of come up and pop up out of nowhere. But people seem to forget that a lot of these hypotheses are quite old. The Japanese capture hypothesis was started by Fred Gerner in 1966. He released The Search for Amelia Earhart, and that was kind of a very popular book, and it still is. It remains one of the most popular books, and was kind of considered to be sort of the godfather of that Japanese capture hypothesis and all the investigative work he did. And then, you know, in 1970, just a few years later, you know, Amelia Earhart Lives comes out. And that was Joe Kloss, Joe Jervis, and that kind of birthed the whole Irene Bolam hypothesis, and it's been around ever since then. Nikumaroro, Island Castaway, that has been worked by the Tiger Group, International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, for about 30 years now. So that's been around for quite some time. And, you know, the newest one is about a decade old, and that's the Buka hypothesis. And there's a few other ones out there, but I would say that, you know, it's just the mystery of what happened and not knowing, and the fact that she was so famous and that she was so well known and so well, the key here is well loved. This is a woman who was America's sweetheart at the time. She still is America's sweetheart all these years later. And we don't know what happened to America's sweetheart. We want to bring her home. You know, the United States really has a military, mentality. We want to bring all of our men and women home, and we never got to bring her home, her or Fred. In this case, we don't know. And if let's play the devil's advocate and say that tomorrow it's determined that she did in fact die in Saipan, or she did in fact die in Japanese custody. a lot of folks would believe that she would be the very, you know, she would be the first victim of World War II, and that she would she should be honored as a war hero, especially if it's proven that she was in fact spying for the U.S., or even if it was against her will and she was just doing it as a favor because of what everything that happened with the ground loop, however you want to look at it. It's one of those things where we want to bring a finite end to this story, and it's the biggest question mark, easily the top five question marks of all time. You know, arguably it might be the number one question mark of all time. Certainly in aviation, I think if her plane was found tomorrow, regardless of where it was found, that would be the holy grail of aviation, and it would be one of those things where it would just be an incredible find. It'd probably be one of the biggest finds certainly in the history of the world, but definitely in the United States history. And if it is in fact sitting in the bottom of the ocean. A lot of folks have argued on our show and put data on there that it would be relatively intact and almost in full shape the way it hit the water due to the currents and due to the actual the environment of the water. So it's one of those situations where whether we drag that plane up out of the water tomorrow or whether she's discovered that she died on Saipan or in Japanese custody or whether it's discovered that she made it back and she died in her bed as an old lady. You know, that's sort of romantic and sort of poetic that she would have made it back and maybe died in her bed died of old age. That's maybe, you know, I mean, none of these things are pleasant. If she crashed and sank in the ocean, that's a terrible way to go. If she died of dysentery in a Japanese prison cell, that's a god awful way to go. If she was executed, I mean, there's no good outcome for how she ended her life. The only one that is a semblance of good is really the fact that she might have made it back. And even that is almost a death in and of itself, because imagine if you were in her shoes and you essentially, you know, Amelia Earhart, as you knew it, was dead. You couldn't talk to your husband. You couldn't talk to your mother, your sister, your family. You were essentially dead to the world, and you had to live your life in anonymity, and you had to live your life out. But basically the first witness protection, you know, people ever.
Yeah.
It's a very lonely and sad way to go. And I can imagine the depression that she would have had and all that stuff, whether she would have wanted it at first or not because of the, you know, maybe the chance to get out of the limelight a little bit. It's very sad how her life ended, regardless of how you look at it. But we as a team choose to sort of talk about, you know, how she lived and talk about how the example that she set. And she, you know, was fully aware at the time that, you know, I know what I'm going to do once, you know, like Forrest quoted in the beginning of the Astonishing Legend show, you know, once I had given it a little bit of attention, there really was no good reason to refer to it. She kind of gave it its due that I might not come back. And after that was the case, she decided to throw it out. And she went just like everything she did with her life. She was a fly by the seat of your pants kind of girl. And she took risks, and she was risky, and she was a little cocky, and she wanted to go out with a bang, and, you know, boy, did she ever.
One of the cool things that I like about your show is that you're not actually trying to answer that question, not directly at
least.
It's not like you're putting it out there, and you're really more celebrating her as a person and as the historical kind of America's sweetheart, like you said. All the theories are great, and it'd be great if one of the people on your show ended up being right. I don't care which one it is.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where we just want to showcase it all, and you know, somebody's gonna get the "I told you so" moment. But you know, who knows? I mean, at this rate, it could be something. I mean, I can tell you this much: I'm fairly certain that one of them's right. I'll give you that. There's not much more of an option as far as what could have happened to her. You know, for the most part, once this project is complete, I think the answer is there somewhere. You just have to kind of decide for yourself what you believe. And, you know, we may never find out what happened to Amelia Earhart. I choose to remain optimistic. I think in my lifetime, I'm hoping that we will find out. We'll either discover the plane, we'll drag it out of the water, or we'll find out if she was imprisoned in Japan for sure, definitively. I think somebody will find out what happened. And I think it's probably one of our phenomenal guests that we have working their respective hypothesis. You know, for us, it really isn't about who's right. It's about writing the final chapter. It's about the season finale. Mm-hmm. It's about putting this to bed, bringing her home, and allowing her to rest finally in peace. And finally write the last chapter to this incredible story. And we're just trying to do our part. And I can tell you that, you know, we certainly will not be the last Amelia Earhart project that's going to be released. But I'd like to say that we'll be the definitive project at the end of the day, because we'll have so much information out there that, you know, you're not going to be able to start studying Amelia Earhart without stumbling upon the Chasing Earhart project in some way, shape, or form. Whether it's the podcast or whether it's the documentary or whether it's the website or whether it's, you know, the events that we do or things that we're covering, you know, our goal is to just kind of is to be the spark that ignites discovery, ignites change, ignites discussion, ignites sharing, you know, maybe coming together and putting differences aside and trying to, you know, really just put a final end to this thing. And, you know, when I was little, my dad used to tell me, look, you know, we used to do these puzzles together, 500,000, 1500 piece puzzles. And he used to tell me, it's like a metaphor for life. When you're working on something, it's like, you got to have every piece of the puzzle or you can't make it the correct decision. You never know what you're missing. You never know what that piece could leave out. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, I relate that to this. Is it possible that everybody is working their respective piece of the puzzle and everybody's just working on this giant puzzle together? Whether you believe in a specific hypothesis or not, the work that's being done on that hypothesis is crucial to the overall puzzle being completed.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of how we look at it. And we just have absolutely nothing but respect for everybody that we involve in this project. All of our project guests, whether they're working a hypothesis, whether they're an archaeologist, a scientist, an author, an astronaut, a pilot, whatever it is, we have a lot of respect and we give them the same respect and the same platform that we give anybody on the show. You know, everybody gets the same treatment. And, I had this grand idea to do this thing years ago, and now
are you regretting that yet or no?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of sleepless nights, not because I got Earhart on my mind, but it's just because I got so much work to do. This is something I promised myself I would be all in until it's over, until the project releases. And I told that to my team. Anybody we bring on board the team, nobody gets paid. I have not made a dime. As a matter of fact, I have footed the bill for a lot of the travel for our shoot team to different states to shoot the documentary and stuff. You know, I was so against any kind of fundraising for the show. I really love the grassroots approach that we take for the project. I really think the irony is sort of beautiful. The largest scale Amelia Earhart project ever put out, hands down, no contest. We have almost 200 guests on the project. We'll have 60 to 80 in the documentary. We have 14-part documentary series coming out. 14 hours, we're toying with a 15th hour of documentary. And we're going to have probably 200 or 300 episodes of the podcast by the time that the project's done. It's going to be covered. If it can be covered, it's going to be covered. And we do not have a corporate sponsor. We are not majorly funded. We are not backed by anybody big. What's interesting about our show, if you listen to our show, the one thing you won't hear is you won't hear an ad. It's true. That's really interesting. And that we've gotten a lot of we've gotten a lot of great comments about that. Hey, you know, we really appreciate the fact that you guys don't do ads. We hate listening to ads. You know, and at the same time, I totally get why podcasters use ads, because it helps pay the bills, helps them put a better quality show on, helps them dedicate more of their lives to it and give people the entertainment that they love and they subscribe to. And I'm totally all about that. If we had, someone that wanted to advertise in the show, we probably would, you know, do it as long as it meshes with what we're doing. But we're at this time, 23 episodes in, have not aired a single ad. It's all about the meat and potatoes. It's all about the project. It's all about the interviews. For the longest, you know, for the first several episodes of the show, I used to, you know, come on there and rattle off what we have going on the project and everything. And I love doing that because I wanted to keep people informed. But about four or five episodes ago, I stopped doing that. If you notice now, we have about a minute and then I do a quick synopsis on the episode and go right into the interview. And then at the end of the interview, I just thank people for joining us. Have them rate the show on iTunes, and you know, we're out. We'll see you next week with this guest. We try to keep it cut and dry because it's not about me. People don't want to hear me talk. They want to hear the guest talk, and we totally get that. So we're always trying to innovate and trying to make changes and trying to make the show better. We're just very, we're very honored to be doing what we're doing. It's not at work. It's a lot of fun. We kicked off this. Today was a kind of a banner day for the project because we kicked off the promotion for a really special event we have coming up in July, about a little over six months from now. And that is going to add even more to my plate.
A little bit.
Yeah, so it's going to add even more to my plate, add even more to my wife, who is our project coordinator. She's I can't do this without her because she's the liaison between us and all of our guests and all of the the people we're working with. And essentially, what we've done is about a year ago or so, I had the idea to do a discussion panel. What it was it was going to be a representation of the almost 200 guests we have on the Chasing Earhart project, and we. We're recently out in Atchison, Kansas in July. We bookended the first phase of the project in Atchison at the 2017 Amelia Earhart Festival. And wow. My wife fell in love with the ambiance out here, and she fell in love with the area. And we decided to move the project here, at least move us here, because we have people scattered all over the country that work on the project. But we chat via Zoom and everything. We remote in to each other and have conferences together. But my wife really loved it here, and so she wanted to move here, and we had an opportunity to do that. And we decided to move the home base of the project out to Atchison, Kansas. And it was really one of the best things we ever did because Atchison really is the mecca for Amelia Earhart. You have the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum right here on the Missouri River. You have the Forest of Friendship. You have Trinity Church, where she was baptized. You have the brand new airport museum that's actually being worked on right now with Muriel, the last Lockheed Electric Tinny on the planet. You have a lot of great ambiance when it comes to Amelia Earhart. And then, of course, every year, every summer, about five times the amount of people that live in Atchison descend on Atchison for the Amelia Earhart Festival. And the festival is a big hit. They have a major, you know, big, huge carnival at the festival for kids and families. They have Lake Fest here with a lot of country acts, and they've had pretty much everybody you can think of that's been a big country name has been in the show or been at the Lake Fest show. You have some wonderful women, Jackie Prejean and Karen Seberg, who run this whole thing, who make this thing happen every year. And they're just the way they do what they do and handle what they handle is beyond me. It's pretty incredible. And so I kind of talked with Jackie and Karen about it, and we kind of told them about this idea. And before I really pitched it to them, I wanted to get a guest list together, potentially. If we invited you, would you come? And we have this panel, unlike any other panel that's ever come before it when it comes to Amelia Earhart, is going to surprise a lot of people. And when I showed them the guest list of people that we had confirmed with, or were working on confirming with, they were pretty much blown away because they're names that they would never imagine would come to Atchison for the festival. And we've locked down Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas, which is a gorgeous school. It's got a really beautiful auditorium, the O'Malley McAllister Auditorium, that houses about 500 people. And it's got a full-blown, you know, audio-video setup in there where you can showcase, we're going to showcase and world premiere the theatrical trailer for the documentary.
That's awesome.
And, you know, we have these guests. And so I started reaching out to these guests. And I had a set of 20 individuals in mind. And, you know, we're kind of working out the logistics on who's going to actually, how many people are going to actually be on the panel. But every one of the people that I reached out to said, absolutely, would love to come. The idea here is to really showcase the Chasing Earhart Project, the grassroots approach that we're taking, the uniqueness of the project, bringing all these individuals together from all these walks of life, the soul and spirit of Atchison, Kansas, and how they keep Amelia's soul and spirit alive, 81 years at that point after she disappeared, and just a lot of other things, you know, her tremendous impact on kids, children, and how that all works, her impact on pop culture and why she still has so much staying power all this time later. And, you know, today we, after all these preliminary meetings and all these months of work, we officially kicked off, the team kicked it off today. We announced the first two guests, and our first two guests are Abigail Harrison, who is known as Astronaut Abby professionally. Yeah. She is founder of the Mars Generation. She was on the podcast. She was episode 7, I believe. And she wants to be the first person on Mars. She's got a pretty incredible story. And she's got a massive following on Twitter and social media and everything. And she's really a big deal in the aviation and aerospace community. She's a Goodwill ambassador for NASA. She is a huge advocate in STEAM, science, technology, engineering, mm-hmm. Arts, mathematics. Yeah. She's just an incredible example of Amelia Earhart, what she stood for. And our second guest that we announced alongside of Abby is Shasta Ways. Shasta is, gosh, there's really not much. It's hard to put into words. She was born in a refugee camp in Afghanistan. She is the youngest woman. She just completed her world flight. She's the youngest woman to fly around the world in a single engine aircraft. Wow. Solo. She used that jump off and that kind of that fame from that flight and founded the Dream Soar Foundation, which really kind of works with other young women to you know, help their dreams come true when it comes to aviation. And also, she's a huge advocate of STEM. The whole Dream Soar Foundation is a huge advocate of STEM, and we're, you know, these are two women, these are rock stars of aviation and aerospace. And they're our first two guests, and we announced them officially today. We kicked that off, and they're very excited to be there. Neither one of them have been to Atchison, and our team is going to every 2 weeks starting today with the first announcement today of Abby and Shasta. We're going to announce another guest every 2 weeks until the entire panel is released.
That's awesome.
We'll be kicking off promotion today. We'll be going 100 miles an hour until July, until this gets out. And we're excited about it. It's just a representation of what Chasing Earhart represents. And we're gonna put on one hell of a show. And we're going to get people excited about Amelia Earhart. And they're going to get excited about the Chasing Earhart Project. And they're going to get excited about the people that we have involved, most importantly, these two powerhouse nonprofit organizations of the Mars Generation and Dream Soar. These are women that can come together and change the world. Literally, I mean, they can change the world. And if we can be a liaison for that, if they can come under the umbrella of the project and introduce these two women and put them together, it's a blessing beyond words. That's just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to, you know, 2 weeks, in 2 weeks on the 15th, we're going to release guest number 3. it's exciting. It's just more to the plate on top of the podcast every week and on top of interviews and on top of the shoot schedule for a documentary and on top of press and on top of all that stuff. It's a full-time job.
That's so cool. It's almost like Amelia's kind of watching over you guys. You know, it seems like definitely had a big influence on you that you kind of moved back right into her home state again and her hometown for that matter. And then, you definitely have a lot of parallels between what you guys are doing, her mindset, and it's kind of neat.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. It's just a blessing. I'm just trying to receive that blessing. And I'm really big on, you know, my faith, and, you know, we don't really talk about that too much in, you know, on the promotional stuff side of it, but you know, my wife and I have a really strong faith and a real strong belief that we're meant to be here and this is all meant to happen, and that, you know, people, places, and things can be moved into your path. You know, it's your responsibility to act.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to act and receive everything we can. And, you know, we're trying to do this in honor of a woman who, you know, has inspired us. Not just us. I mean, this is a woman who's inspired millions of people. She definitely warrants a project of this size and scope. We're going to give it to them, and it's going to be pretty special. And we're just happy to be part of it. It's I've always been more of an introvert kind of deal, and it's funny that I started this thing in a room by myself, just doing pre-research and writing longhand all these notes down. And now, you know, 9 years or whatever it's been later, I remember telling my wife in the beginning when I sent out the first set of emails to people that, you know, this is probably going to take 3 or 4 years to even get off the ground and get traction. And that was in February of this year.
Wow.
And of last year. And it's like, it's pretty incredible that, you know, we started shooting it in March. It's mind blowing. It's the mind reels what you can accomplish when you just kind of get tunnel vision and keep your head down and keep pushing forward. And
when you anticipate the documentary coming out in another year or so,
that's
right?
A good question. It's going to be my grave. The documentary is scheduled to come out in fall of 2019. We don't have an exact date in fall of 2019, but that's the schedule release. Now, if the documentary gets picked up and distributed by a larger corporation or a larger distributor, then at that point it's all out of our hands, and they would just take it and they might push it to the following summer or whenever they'd want to release it at that point.
Right.
But the goal is to have it packaged and ready to go by the end of the year of 2019. If, you know, that's kind of the nice part about the grassroots aspect of not working for anybody, not having a big corporate sponsor, is that I don't have to answer to anybody. Mm-hmm. So
no pressure.
I want to take an extra couple months to edit and clean up stuff and to make things, let's take an extra couple months because we want to shoot these individuals' interviews. So, you know, we finally got them. Let's take the time to do it. We can do that. It's not going to hurt anything. But, you know, we do realize at the end of the day, you have to put some kind of a date on it. And so we're thinking fall 2019, but it could shift. It could change. A lot could happen in the next 2 years. So
the cool thing is that, you know, now if you were going to go write that report in third grade, you'd have a great resource to do it from. You know?
Yeah, that's awesome. I would hope so. You know, we take pride in the fact that a lot of young folks follow the project, a lot of like teenagers. A lot of like early 20s, you know, it's like they follow the project. Like, I've been a fan of Amelia's for a long time. And I read this book and, you know, now because I heard you on Astonishing Legends, or I heard a couple episodes of your show, or I heard a radio interview you did, like I went up and picked out 3 or 4 books on Earhart. And I'm all in. I love it. And, you know, that's the biggest compliment we can get. That's really what we're greedy for that. We're not really greedy. You know, we're not greedy for money. This is not a project that's about, you know, financial value. This is really about historic and intrinsic value. You know, we just started a Patreon not too long ago. It was something that was, I wasn't really a big fan of doing at first. I want to kind of do it on my own and everything, but the team sort of convinced me that, you know, hey, this is a fantastic way that for people to kind of who love and appreciate everything that we're doing to help out, and we can give them stuff for doing it. So people have been asking for shirts and stickers and patches and stuff for like 6 months now. Now we're finally going to be able to give them to them. And I thought, well, we'll do the Patreon then, I guess. And we'll, you know, everything is appreciated. I mean, it does take funding to get a project of this scope done, but you know, I don't like asking for money. I never have. It's just not my deal. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's just a grassroots project and I can't fund the entire thing.
Right.
If I could, I would love to.
If they wanted to, hypothetically, my listeners could go on. I know you're not asking for it, but I will. Just search for Chasing Earhart on Patreon and they can donate on there and find all the information.
I think it's just patreon.com/chasing Earhart. You know, we have a lot of really neat stuff we're going to do for rewards for patrons and stuff. And you know, it's exciting for us. I just have to embrace the entire thing. You know, introverts aren't naturally comfortable. And I've kind of had to come out of my shell in the last year and a half or so and really just kind of, you know, put myself out there and do shows like this one.
That's why most of us have made podcasts of our own, because we just talk in a closet to ourselves, you know, so.
It's a good way to kind of express yourself without having to express yourself in front of people, not in front of people, literally. You're pre-recording everything. Yeah, definitely.
Is there anything else that we haven't talked about? This is actually one of my longer interviews. Is there anything else that you'd want my listeners to know that we haven't talked about already?
You know, I would just say, you know, I encourage all your listeners to give the project a look or a listen if they want to do the podcast. We have, you know, we really pride ourselves on being a transparent, informative, interactive team. Chances are, if you hit the website, you know, there is a chat icon at the bottom right corner of the website. Chances are, during the day, if you hit the website and you chat with somebody or you ping us with a message, somebody will be watching over that site and will chat with you about Amelia Earhart, or if you have a question about the project or the Patreon or the podcast or the panel or whatever it is, in general information, they'll chat with you. We have a really great team. And I want to give a shout out to my team. And, you know, the Chasing Earhart team is pretty incredible. The web team, our social media team, you know, our shoot team, our DPs, our camera guys, you know, all that stuff. Our graphic design team has been incredible. I'm the only one that everybody sees. But I really go out of my way to try to give them, you know, the proper due. It's really important. And, you know, they'll all be at that panel, or most of them will be at that panel in July, and we'll be able to give them a proper due in front of everybody. The website has been redesigned. You go to the website and you look at the top navigation bar, there's a tab called The Chase, and that's really just kind of the meat and potatoes of the project. Everything is in there. Every interview that we've ever done got its own individual post. You can, you know, Facebook comment on it on the website. You can share it on Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. You know, we're constantly evolving as a project. And that's kind of the IT in our team, I think, is we're always trying to evolve social media, website-wise, you know, interactiveness and all that stuff. Check out our YouTube page. Just kind of subscribe to the podcast. We just want people to get fired up and excited about a project like this. There's never been one like it. We pride ourselves on that. And, you know, we're honored and we're blessed to be doing this. And it was an honor for me to be on your show. I've been a big fan of this show for a while. And I know it's been a long time coming for us to chat. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm really glad that your social media team, as you were talking about, your great team, they've been awesome. The interactions I've had with them, too. So they've been great. And I'm glad that they hooked us up, too. So this has been a really great interview, you know, with Amelia and just the project as a whole. It's really neat. I mean, I haven't heard of anybody doing the dual kind of podcast documentary at the same time, at least not deliberately.
Yeah.
I know sometimes podcasts turn into documentaries inadvertently, but kind of cool to hear somebody doing it the other way around, you know?
Yeah, definitely. We want to be a first, want to be a trailblazer for that. And it's, you know, it's definitely doable. It really becomes sort of a full-time job, but it's an exciting one. And if you love what you do, and it's not work. I mean, everybody's heard that before, and it really isn't. It's just, it's work in a sense of like, you have to get it done, but it's a lot of fun doing it. And the stories we hear and the experiences we have as a team, are pretty remarkable. And it's, you know, all of it's been just a complete huge blessing for us. And, we're just going to keep going and, you know, this thing will come out and, you know, we will have a huge archive when we're done and, we're excited about it. So it's a great project. I'm really passionate about it.
I can tell. And I think that hopefully my listeners can tell too. I appreciate you coming on the show in case I forget. So thank you very much for taking, you know, a good 2 hours out of your night to do that. But I know it seems like a while.
Yeah.
How would my listeners follow you, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, and can people start buying tickets for the event yet? Or when does that come up? Plug all that stuff.
Definitely. Yeah, I know. That's a great question. So ticketing, we're still working that out, how that's going to work out. We're working the kinks out on some of the ticketing and how we're going to offer tickets. I can tell you for sure that if you do subscribe to the website, of course, subscribing to the website doesn't cost you anything.
Right.
When you go to the website, you know, you'll see a pop-up, a light box will come up asking for your name and your email address. You don't have to stick in your name, but it does help. So we know who we're talking to. When you subscribe to the website, you know, you get all the podcasts, approximately 24 hours before everybody else gets it. You'll get some bonus content. And then when the tickets do get released, you will be the first to actually have access. We'll have some VIP access for the tickets if you're a subscriber to the site. So it's just a way of thanking people. And again, it doesn't cost anything. It's totally free. If you want to reach out to us, the website is our baby. That's the best place to go. That's got everything on it. If you go to the website, chasingearhart.com, top right corner, you'll see, of course, the link to our Patreon. We have our little Patreon banner up there, but you'll also see the link to all of our social media up there as well. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, our SoundCloud that hosts our podcast. We're also on Audioboom as well. We're on every major podcast app that you can think of, iTunes, of course, Google Play, all that good stuff. We have a brand new YouTube channel. If you subscribe to the YouTube channel, we're trying to get to our first 100 subscribers so that way we can get a custom YouTube URL. We're about halfway there. So if you want to subscribe and click that button on YouTube, that'd be great. Basically, our social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, the handle is @ChasingEarhart. Very straightforward. And you can check us out there. You can, you know, subscribe to various aspects of the project, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever you got, subscribe to it. You can follow it. And you'll want to do that because this panel kicked off today, the actual promotion for it. And it's going to be, like I said, 100 miles an hour until the panel starts. And we're going to be doing a lot of updates and a lot of stuff going on. You know, that's basically how you can subscribe to us. It's got, you know, our website's got my direct email address on there. If you want to reach out to me directly, I make myself very available for people who want to talk, you know, air hard, ask, talk about the project, whatever the case is. I'm not above talking to anybody on that. And yeah, that's pretty much everything. So chasingearhart.com, that's a good place to start. And social media at chasingearhart. So,
all right, yeah. Chris. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Seriously, this has been just phenomenal all around. See, I'm speechless. So that means you did something right if I can shut up. So you're good to go then. And definitely thank you for coming on. And hopefully you guys will come on if there's any new updates. Or if they actually pull up that plane, I want you on the podcast. So
that would be great. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it. It's been an honor. It's been fun chatting with you.
All right. Thank you so much.
That was pretty awesome. That was totes amazing. Wowers. That's really great.
Great.